And welcome to the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com. You can listen to it on iTunes at opednews.com/podcasts, at Progressive Radio Network, and at Stitcher. My guest on this show is Michael Kimmel. He's a distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York, the author or editor of more than 20 books, including Manhood in America, The Gendered Society, The History of Men, and Guyland. I got interested in him because he's got a book out called Angry White Men, Masculinity at the End of an Era. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be with you.
So in the beginning of your book, you describe the book as the book that describes Trump's supporters, even though it wasn't written about Trump.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, originally I wrote the book. The book was published in 2013, and the name Trump doesn't appear in the book anywhere. And so after, of course, the press, the primaries, and then the election, I realized that I had kind of written a book not about Trump or the Trump phenomenon, but really about his followers. Why were so many white men particularly so attracted to this kind of populism? And so I went back and wrote a new preface to the book, basically trying to situate what I was trying to do. But really my concern in the book is about what I perceive as angry white men as a kind of general phenomenon. And my first encounter with it took place probably 10, 15 years ago. I was on a TV talk show opposite four white men who were, they said, the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace. White men said that affirmative action was really reverse discrimination against white men. And you probably know this as well, but a higher percentage of white people in America believe that they have experienced racial discrimination than black people. So, it's really quite astonishing, right? So I was on the show opposite these four guys. These four guys said that they were the victims of reverse discrimination. And the reason I took this as epigrammatic for the book, my first encounter with so-called angry white men, was the title of the show. It was a quote from one of the men. And the quote was, "A black woman stole my job." They all told their stories about this. And then when I was asked to speak, I said, I just have one question for you guys. And it's about the title of the show, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." Actually, it's about one word in the title. I want to know about the word "my." Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't the title of the show "A Black Woman Got the Job" or "A Black Woman Got a Job"? Because I believe that that idea of entitlement is the key to understanding why so many white men feel so put upon, feel so victimized in the United States today. They believe that they are entitled to those positions, and when they don't get them, they really feel angry about it. And look, let's be really clear about this. If aristocracies historically don't like meritocracy, they don't like to play fair. They don't like for the best to win. They like it so that everything's tilted like this, so that they get everything. So white men are not big fans in some respects of democracy, of substantive, real democracy, where everybody has an equal chance. Because we've benefited for so long at dramatic inequality. We thought that was normal.
So the democracy, if it works for you, then it's great. If it does,
democracy for me, but too bad for you.
Okay, so where do you go with this?
Well, so this idea of what I call aggrieved entitlement is kind of the underlying foundation for a lot of different groups of aggrieved men, of men who feel victimized, who feel put upon. So the book basically covers four or five different groups. I talk about angry white boys, for example, because as you probably know, virtually all of the school shooters, all of the mass, the mass rampage school shooters were white suburban boys. They weren't inner city black boys. They were white suburbanites, white suburban boys. And so that, so I asked, like, what's going on with them? I look at guys who go postal in the workplace, or guys who are, you know, sort of violent, become violent in the workplace. And I talk about them a little bit and what goes on for them. I talk about the men's rights groups, which are very active on the internet. You know, the manosphere, the men going their own way, the anti-feminist men who basically think that their lives suck because women have it all. Or father rights groups, who are men who basically have become aggrieved as dads because their wives got custody, or they don't have as much time with their kids or whatever. And finally, the last chapter is based on interviews with white nationalists, neo-Nazis, white supremacists around the country, who are obviously sort of now legitimized in the alt-right. But I was looking even further than that. I wasn't just looking at alt-right Breitbart News reading guys. I was looking at guys who were in militias or in, neo-Nazis and white nationalists. Richard Spencer types.
It's quite a spectrum that you cover then.
That's right. But all of them have that one thing in common, which is they believe that as white men, they have been badly done by. They've gotten screwed by this system.
And they have an aggrieved entitlement. That's
right.
Like the kind of hallmark of the concept of your book.
Right, exactly. That's the phrase that I came up with to describe them. They feel entitled, but they're not getting what they feel entitled to.
So talk a little bit more about aggrieved entitlement. How does that develop?
Well, I think let me say a little bit about the guys I start with. The first chapter of the book is really the Trump guys, the Tea Party guys, the guys who listen to Mike Savage and Rush Limbaugh and basically feel like that everybody else is getting theirs except them, except us. We're the ones who are getting screwed. My feeling about this, so talking to them, the idea of aggrieved entitlement, I think, comes from a general belief in the American dream. The idea that you should be able, any man should be able to work hard, play by the rules, pay his taxes, and he should be able to buy his own house and support his family by himself. He should be able to do it. That's what my father believed. That's what my grandfather believed, that they should be breadwinners. Being a breadwinner, being a provider, that was the anchor of American masculinity for two centuries. So these guys feel, many of them feel like they have paid their dues. They have, they've worked hard. They've paid their taxes. They've done what they're told. They've been good soldiers. And now they're not getting the rewards. Now they can't support a family by themselves. Their wives have to work. Now they can't afford a house anymore, or they've gotten a predatory loan, or they've lost so much. And they feel like somebody else is getting all the rewards here, but I'm not. I was told, play by the rules, you'll be okay. And I'm not okay. So, and a lot of these guys told me kind of honestly, if you had told me in the beginning that I wasn't going to get all the rewards that I was promised, I wouldn't have done it. Right. So here's my argument, Rob. I think they're right. I think they have been screwed. I think they have been dealt a bad hand. They believe they bought the system that their grandfathers bought. They bought into that idea from the 1950s. It's no accident that when you ask Trump supporters, when was America great? If we're going to make America great again, when was it great? It's not an accident that they all say the 1950s, which was, by the way, one of the highest tax eras in our history, an era of massive government spending, the interstate highway system, the GI Bill, the building of so many suburban schools. The government created the suburbs in the 1950s, in part through massive taxation and massive government spending. So it's really ironic to hear these guys say, oh, the government was great in the 50s. Because what the 50s represent to them was a man, like in Levittown, could buy his house, stake his claim, be a provider to a family and get the respect that he felt he deserved. And they can't do that anymore. Wages for a family of four in the United States are exactly the same in constant dollars today as they were in 1974. Exactly the same, within a few dollars. But what's different between in a family of four between 1974 and now? Mom's working. It really does take two incomes to earn what one income earned two generations ago. So it really is true that these guys have been screwed. Now, here's the thing that I think is interesting. We talk about the Trump phenomenon as a populist movement, right? We have all heard that. It's populist. And I think populism is the right term to use. But populism isn't a theory. Populism is an emotion. And the emotion is we have been screwed by the system. Now, the populism could go to the right, think, for example, Trump or Italian fascism, or it could go to the left, think Spanish anarchists, think Bernie Sanders, think Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen is a populist. He believes that the white working class has gotten completely screwed. So what determines whether your populist emotion takes you to the right or to the left? I think the answer is race. If you believe that they, meaning people of color, have gotten all the benefits, then you have a racial divide between white and black, and you move to the right. If you believe that we're all in the same boat, and that as Sanders says, the millionaires and billionaires have been the ones who've gotten all the rewards, then you make common cause across race, and you move to the left. So populism can go either way. It's an emotion, and currently in the United States, we are being propelled by that emotion that the system isn't working for us. And if we see that not working for other people, immigrants, people of color, LGBT people, women, etc., if we make common cause, that's a populism of the left. If we say, the hell with them, give us ours, that's a populism of the right.
So why do these white, angry white men say to hell with them, with all the other people who are being screwed?
Because the way they see it, a friend of mine, Arlie Hochschild, sort of uses this metaphor in her work, and I think it's kind of interesting. She says it's that basically you feel, these guys feel like they have been very patient, sort of like what I was saying before. They feel like they have been very patiently standing in line, and they've been waiting their turn. And now here come all these other people, immigrants, women, gay people, people of color, and they're cutting in line right in front of them. So they say, hey, that's not fair. So they go to the government and they say, hey, government, these people are cutting in line in front of me. That's not fair. And the government says, deal with it. Get used to it. Suck it up. Too bad. And that's how they feel. They feel the government is on the side of all these people cutting in line in front of them.
But everybody's getting screwed.
Well, so that's a statement of populism of the left, right? If you see everybody getting screwed, then you would want to make common cause with them. If you see that your group is getting screwed and they're benefiting through welfare and food stamps and healthcare, whatever they get, then you want to screw them and get yours.
So why? Why is that? Why do white men see it in that way? Why is it that they don't see that we're all together on this?
Because they made a bet. And the bet was that they, if they played their cards right, they could basically have the lives that their grandfathers had.
And what was that bet?
The bet was that they could have it, that they could have that life. Well, and they can't. They lost. They lost that bet. The world is completely different. The coal mines have closed, and it's not because people of color have taken all those jobs. Right, our entire industrial movement has moved away from the places where they made that bet that they could work in heavy industry, or they could work in the steel industry, or that they could work in the coal industry, or that they could work in heavy manufacturing. And those jobs have dried up. It's not because immigrants have taken them; it's because the jobs don't exist anymore. And so, who outsource those jobs? You think immigrants outsource those jobs? You think lesbians outsource those jobs? Of course not. It's the bankers and financial institutions and the corporate CEOs. Those are the ones who actually made working class white men's lives so much more difficult. But the job of those people is to make sure that you don't blame them, but you blame everybody else. So they're doing a great job.
Yeah, they sure are. So how are the bankers and it's nothing new. I mean, Michael Moore wrote a book, Stupid White Men, back, I guess, around 2000.
Yeah, that's right. And Al Franken wrote a book about the lying liars and the lies that they tell. And I mean, look, you know, and look, you have a book behind you by your right over your right shoulder, It Can't Happen Here, which is a book that talks about this from the turn of the last century. We have been constant. The populist movement in the United States in the 1890s was a populist movement that started out on the left, was farmers and workers.
Right.
So the question really is, this isn't new, but and in a funny way, I argue in Angry White Men, this not only isn't new, but it may be its last gasp. This may be
historical.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. I'm very optimistic. This may be the last gasp.
Why do you think that?
Well, because I think, first of all, that it will become evident gradually or very soon that the policies of our current administration are designed to screw the very people that put him in the White House. And I think that that's inevitable. I think, you know, those jobs aren't coming back. The collapse of the efforts to repeal Obamacare, the efforts to repeal, I mean, these, you know, Medicaid, Medicare, these are things that that people, white people in rural areas depend on. In fact, they just don't think it's going to happen to them. You know, they're the ones like Sinclair Lewis who are saying, couldn't happen here. I mean, they wouldn't come to rural Iowa and take away Medicaid. Oh, no. Right? Well, of course they will. You know, so my feeling about this is I'm optimistic because I see, for example, the men's rights movement. They are increasingly vocal, but increasingly small in number. Or decreasingly large, I suppose.
Tell us more about the men's rights movement.
The men's rights movement basically says that men are, white men are in trouble, struggling because women have it all, because women make all the decisions, women have all the power, and so these are guys who either opt out of the dating scene. They're called men going their own way. They refuse to the dating scene, which empowers women. They think that feminism is a disease that has ruined men's lives, that has created tremendous gender inequality, that women now, that there's more female privilege than male privilege. They have a whole bunch of, sort of examples of this, and some father rights movements also are angry at women.
I publish op-ed news, and I've had encounters with father rights guys, and they're just so angry, over the top angry.
Yeah. I think the father rights guys, some of them have a point, I think. I take your point that in op-ed news that a lot of these angry fathers are furious, and I think they're massaged. They don't start angry. They start bereft. They start unhappy. They start sad. They start bewildered because they were good, decent fathers. And then suddenly they lose. They feel like they've lost everything in a very unequal judicial system.
It's not always been my experience, though. I've dealt with some who literally have had court orders against them seeing their kids because they've been anything but good fathers, and they're still
fair enough.
And that group also is angry at women, and you know they're part of this fathers movement too. On the other hand, I had custody of my kids, and I know that in my county only about 20% of men get custody. It's a very unusual thing. I mean, fathers is about being a father is about having kids.
And right, but I would ask you this.
Barely by the court system.
Yeah, so I would ask you this. So 20% of fathers get custody. What county are you in?
Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so 20% of fathers. But what percentage of men ask for custody?
No, that's true too.
I mean, what we know from studying California is that 80% of divorcing couples get the custody arrangements they want.
Really?
80%. Now, of the remaining 20%, we're talking only really about those couples in which the wife wants sole custody and the husband wants joint custody. That's the place where they end up being really, really bitter.
Man.
That's the one where they get the court orders. That's the one where they get the... And of course, you can imagine a guy who feels... there's no objective measure here. Who feels he's really put in his share. He's really been a great dad. He's really been a partner. He's really been there for the little kids. And he's worked his ass off to try to support the family, etc. And he feels like now, after all this, he's going to be treated as if he were Don Draper. As if he were kind of an absentee landlord. As if he never went to his daughter's soccer game. As if he never coached his son's little league game. As if he never hung out with the kids. You know? And my feeling is some of those guys have a point. Because I think the judicial system, family court, very often treats fathers as if they were in the 1950s Don Drapers.
So basically what you're saying is that 80% of people get what they wanted. 80% of couples get what they wanted. 20% don't. And usually it's because the mother is asking for full custody to take it away from the father. What percentage of those 20% of the population, what percentage of the women get that?
Well, so of the 20% who don't get the custody arrangements they want, there are several options. He wants sole, she wants joint. She wants sole, he wants joint. He wants sole, she wants sole. There are different arrangements that are possible. In that arrangement, they can't, they have to be able to, you know, I don't know the actual numbers, but those they have to be able to negotiate that. Now, very often, those are the cases in family court that go to mediators. Those are the cases. But you're absolutely right, Rob. I mean, there are also cases in which the woman wants sole custody because the husband's abusive, because the husband's violent, because the husband's drinking. There are, of course, those cases too. But those aren't the overwhelming majority. So I want to be clear that some of the guys who are aggrieved dads have a point. But what happens is that super furious men's rights guys that you're talking about, they colonize them. They say, yeah, the reason that you're so that this is happening is because feminist women and their lawyers. Right? And that's their sort of anger and rage, I think.
Yeah. Well, so is there an overlap between these guys who don't get custody and don't deserve it, and let's say the white supremacist guy?
No. I mean, they're very separate groups. Although I have to say, I don't know. I mean, I'm not seeing any surveys of the men's rights groups about their presidential campaign, presidential preferences. I would be willing to bet that most of them would identify as libertarian, or even as Democrats. But I would be willing to bet that very few of them pulled the lever for Hillary Clinton. Because she represented everything they hate.
What?
Right?
What
the triumph of women. The triumph of feminism.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what these guys would say to Hillary Clinton is, men's rights are human rights.
So what percentage of men would take that kind of an attitude?
Oh, teeny tiny. They're all gathered. There's a part of the internet called the manosphere that they call the manosphere, which is guys who are part of different kind of websites and website organizations. I don't think they have really they're not like a big organizational phenomenon. There's not like an infrastructure of institutions and movements and groups. They exist to support each other mostly on the internet, which is why I said in Angry White Men that their numbers are decreasing. But they're getting very loud because on the internet you can shout really loud.
Yeah, I got to say that when I walk around and I see guys my age, it's like most of them are going to be Trump supporters. Most of them, I think, are more likely to fit into that population. Does that make any sense to you?
Here.
Pardon me? No, we're having a little internet trouble.
There you're better now. You were fading out for a second. I'm still bad. Sorry.
Oh, man.
Oh, now it's better.
Thank Comcast. I had to go back to Comcast because my others wasn't worth it. And this is so frustrating. What I was saying, I forget what I was saying. I lost track.
You said that you've had some encounters with some of these guys, I think.
Most of the guys my age, I look at them and most of the guys I know tend to be leaning more towards the right, more towards Trump. And a lot of them are that way. So what's the age consideration? I know you got a whole chapter on angry white boys. What about angry old white men?
Well, it's interesting. I talk about it only briefly in the when I talk about the workplace. But you're absolutely right that as white men are aging, I think they're feeling more and more that kind of sense of entitlement. A large number, give you an example. Do you know that the demographic group that it has the highest increase in suicides is middle-aged white men? Now, that's not to say they have the highest rate, but the highest increase over the past 5 years has been middle-aged white men. So you have to read suicide as a kind of despair, as a kind of hopelessness, as a kind of it can't get any better. There's nothing I can do to make it better. So that's the same. I think that's the kind of underbelly of aggrieved entitlement is this system's gone to hell. I can't make my life any better. There's nothing I can do at this point. I'm worth more dead than alive. I'm ill and I can't take care of myself because we don't have adequate health care. You know, we're the only industrial country that doesn't, but we don't. You know, I think, so that's a really...
When you talk middle age, what age are you talking about?
I'm talking about 45 to 60.
45 to 60. So that would be...
Sort of the tail end of Gen X to baby boomers. Gen X to baby boomers.
Gen X
right in between.
Okay, baby boomers, and that makes sense. But are you feeling hope for them, or are you feeling hope that this is going to disappear because of the younger generations, the old 40 years in the desert, like Moses?
Well, it's a very good question. I see us. I'm going to put myself in that category, although I'm slightly older than that. But I'm still in that world of late middle age. I think we're the last generation that bought into that 1950s idea. I think that my father and my grandfather, they live in a completely different world than I do. And I have to say, I have an 18-year-old son. The world that he's moving into is a completely different one. I'll give you one easy example. When my dad was in college, he would sit there and he would talk with his friends. And they would ask this question, are you going to let your wife work? That was the question. And that was a meaningful question to them. And my dad and all the guys basically said, oh, no, she shouldn't have to work. I should be able to support the family. That's my job. She should stay home and take care of the house and the kids. That's what they all answered. Now, when I was in college, I'm 66. When I was in college, we guys asked the same question. You're going to let your wife work. But we answered it like, let? Are you kidding? She's going to do whatever she wants. I have to say, my 18-year-old son, the question is completely meaningless to him. He looked at me like, you ask that? That's ridiculous. Of course my wife's going to work, and maybe she'll let me work too. I mean, they're completely equal. Look at young people's friendships. They are so much more equal. They have so many more cross-sex friends than we did. Their world is entirely different. This old world, which I think we're the last group to buy into, I think, so that's why these guys our age are like, holding on so tenaciously to that old Don Draper ideal, even though the world doesn't look anything like Mad Men. I mean, imagine what, you know, maybe your father's life was like this. My father's life was like this. Like, it looked like the set of Mad Men. All the men had the offices on the outside with the windows, and all the women were kind of in a corral in the center as secretaries, and sexual access to them was kind of a perk. You just, you know, kind of came with the job. Well, that's called sexual harassment. It's illegal. Half of those windowed offices would now be held by women, you know, and there'd be gay people and black people, and, you know, these white guys are going, but those were my offices. I was supposed to be there, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. We're the last generation in terms of age to have expected that. My son has no such sense of entitlement.
Yeah, and it gets back to that aggrieved entitlement. So, I call my show Bottom Up Show because I believe we're transitioning to a more bottom-up culture from the more top-down one that we've had for a long time. Less patriarchy, less hierarchy, less centralization. Where does patriarchy fit into this?
Well, patriarchy is the oldest and most durable form of inequality that we have. It's the mother of all inequalities, you know, or the father of all inequalities, I guess is the way to put it. It's the one that, you know, it's the one where that teaches us how to do inequality. You know, I mean, it starts when we start, but it doesn't mean it's fixed and permanent and unchanging. The power that men have over women, and the power that some men have over other men, is historically developing. It's constantly changing. I think patriarchy is constantly now globally being challenged everywhere in the world. It is now on the global agenda as being something that has to be addressed. The sort of taken for granted inequality, the taken for granted power of men over women, not only in the global South, but in the global North, in Europe. I mean, policies that we are making now to make it safer for women, to make it more possible for women to balance work and family life. These are changes that no one would have expected 50 years ago. You know, like 50 years ago, I think about, I mean, when I was a little kid, you would make jokes like, you know, well, if you can't beat your wife, who can you, if you can't hit your wife, who can you hit? People would say things like that and mean them, right? Like now it's completely ridiculous. So patriarchy is both a constant and constantly changing. And so that means it's challengeable. And I think you're right. I think that we are witnessing an enormous change. You know, you could make the argument, if you were interested in sort of class and economic issues, that this is the last gasp of the absolute top elites to control everything. And if they can't do it under Trump, they're not going to be able to do it again. You know, I feel like they're
encouraging thought.
Yeah, well, I told you I'm an optimist. But I'm an optimist because I believe that anger that people feel below doesn't necessarily go in the direction of the right wing. It can also go left. I think of someone like Bruce Springsteen, who's clearly a populist. He believes in the power of working men, and he talks about their despair. I mean, if you were to read Bruce Springsteen's lyrics without the music, you think this guy's the most depressed white working class guy there is. And yet his music is anthemic, it's propulsive, it's optimistic. So you say, he is clearly a populist. The working guys should be rising up, but he made common cause in his band, in his life, and in his politics with people of color. And that's why he's on the left. That's why he was such a stalwart Obama supporter. You know, Pete Seeger did the same thing. He is another populist of the left. You know, he's going to say, if the whole world can sing the folk songs from around the world, we'll recognize our common humanity. What could be a more simple idea than that?
Is there a way for the left to sway these angry white men who have their anger and populism focusing on the right side because of racism? Is there a way to sway them to the other side?
I'm not sure. I think some. I think we're fighting an uphill battle because they're constantly being told it's, you know, it's the fault of the other, the marginalized. That's why you're not getting yours. So I think it's an uphill climb. We have to get some radio bandwidth that could compete with the Rush Limbaughs and, you know, and the Mike Savages and the ones who are constantly telling them that it's the other, it's everybody else, you know, against you. But I think, but I have great faith in young people. I have great faith in what I'm seeing coming out of, you know, America's colleges and universities, the next generations of leaders.
So what do Limbaugh and Savage do to make things worse?
Well, on the one hand, they give you a steady stream of all the outrageous things that the government is doing that are screwing you. The second thing that they're doing is they're taking your emotion and they're massaging it into a political position. For example, Rush Limbaugh is a master at this. He used to, you know, when people used to call in to the Rush Limbaugh show, I listened one time to a guy call in and say, "Rush, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm really upset. I'm really scared. I lost my job, and I think I'm going to lose. I can't pay the rent on the house, and I have kids, and I can't even afford clothes for them. I'm really afraid, Rush. What should I do?" Limbaugh says, "You don't sound scared. You sound mad. And here's who you should be mad at." And then he gives them a whole list of the egregious things that the liberals are doing. So he takes a genuine emotion and he manipulates it into a political ideology. What I'm talking about is the initial, if the emotion itself is directionless. He massages it to one direction, but it doesn't have to go there. If you look at the last pages of my book, I quote FDR, and a speech by FDR in 1932, announcing some of the CCC and the efforts to combat the Depression, which is another moment of great white working class distress. And what happens? What he says? The title of the speech is "The Forgotten Man," and he argued that what we need to do is we need to create policies that put the resources of the government in the service of those people who are suffering, who are struggling. That's our job in government. Now, the current populist government says our job is to take what little you have left and take it away from you and give it to those above you.
Now, you're talking about the Trump-controlled government.
Right, that's right. So what I'm saying is that the real contrast, there's two. Trump had a similar initiative, a similar sentiment in his campaign. "I am going to be the champion of the forgotten man." That's kind of what he said.
Make America great again.
And so was FDR. FDR was also gonna remember the forgotten man. And what I'm saying is that FDR did it in a way that empowered white working class men to step out of the Depression, to find jobs that the government created for them. And Trump's idea is if we give more money to the bankers and the industrialists, that they will create more jobs. Well, you tell me which one of those has been successful in American history.
Well, we right?
There's only one. Only the New Deal was successful. All of the trickle-down economics made some people exceptionally rich, but did not help normal, regular working class people. So more promises of that are basically just fantasy.
So I'm going to ask you again, how do you sway these guys who are angry and focused on the right kind of populism? How do you sway them to the left?
I'll give you a good example. I'll give you one reform. You may not remember this, but as soon as Obama took office in 2009, one of the first things he said he wanted to do was make community college free in America. You remember that? First, one of the first things he said.
No, I know.
Went nowhere. The Republican Congress just shut it down. Not non-starter. Why did he say that? Why did he want to do that? Because he wanted to give white working class guys who and got men of color and people of color, of course, too. But he wanted to give them an on-ramp into the new economy so that they wouldn't graduate from high school and think that they were going to go into the auto industry or the steel industry or the coal industry or the extractive industries, which are declining in number. But rather give them an on-ramp, give them some training, give them an opportunity to get into the new economy. The Republicans shut that down. There's one way.
I don't even remember hearing that, frankly. I don't.
Yeah, well.
It, and I certainly don't remember hearing the rationale for it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that that, was, would be that wasn't the stated rationale.
My guess is that he didn't get media coverage of that.
No, not much. But the thing is that it went nowhere because the Republicans just shut it down and it never got brought up again. But to me, the answer to this is not to sit, it's not moral suasion. It's not sitting down with these angry white men and talking to them. It's providing the policies that will enable them and their kids to find, to become, see, here's the thing that I think is happening. These white working class men believe this is the idea of entitlement. They believe this was their land. You know, like the Woody Guthrie song says, you know, this land is my land, you know.
So the next line is, this land is your land.
Fair enough. But this land was made for you and me. This is ours. And they have been feeling disconnected from it. They feel terribly patriotic, but they don't trust their government. They love their country, but they hate the government.
Let's talk about that word. You just used the word disconnection.
Now, yeah.
I think that's a really important word.
Because I think so, too. I think they feel disenfranchised. I think they feel cut off. That's why the suicide rate among them is going up. That's why I feel like we need to create policies that enable these guys to feel like stakeholders again, to feel reconnected to the country that they say they love so much. It's not the country of their grandfathers. It's not going to be. No matter how much we want to look backward to when America was great, no matter how much we want to make America great again, it's not happening. We are going to become a majority minority nation in 2042. The generation, the people who will make that happen in 2042, they have been already born. It's a done deal. It's not going to go backwards. Period. So your choice, white man, I would say, is, okay, it's not going to change. So you have choice. You could be dragged kicking and screaming into this new world, or you can say, wow, this world has really changed. What can I do to participate in this new world? That means you have to feel like you're a stakeholder. You have to feel connected.
All right. And so I feel connection, like disconnection, I want to focus on this. You've used it.
Okay, I need to ask how much longer you want to be talking because I have another appointment. Okay.
About 15 minutes.
Okay.
I think this is really important. I think we're transitioned from an information era to a connection era. And there's all these digital ways that we can connect. But I think you're right. I think that there's a huge amount of disconnection and people, and that I think that's a big part of what's going on. So
right.
Get into more depth on how these men are feeling disconnected, disenfranchised, cut off.
More depth on that. Well, I feel like, I feel like that's what I've been saying, you know, throughout our conversation has been that these guys feel that the government is not, that our relationship to the government is somewhat transactional. I play by the rules. I go to work each day. You know, Bruce Springsteen says this in one of his songs. He says, you know, I've done my best, and this is his darkest and most powerful song, I think. He says, I've done my best to live the right way. I get up in the morning and I go to work each day. But sometimes you feel so weak. You just want to explode. The idea is he's done it all. Everything you've told me to do, I've done it. And I'm still not getting where you told me I'd be. You know, and so my choice is I can blame myself, I can blame you, I can blame those other people. So you have a constant chorus in the media on the right wing saying, it's those other people, it's those other people, blame them, blame them. And so we do.
So are you saying then that the right wing media encourages this sense of disconnection?
Of course. It's, you know, the job of the right wing is to keep people who are in roughly the same economic position from making common cause. Because if the white working class if the white, you know, rural farmers make common cause with workers who are white or people of color, we're going to be overwhelmingly a blue country. You know, the only red left would be, you know, ranchers and industrialists.
Yet the Democrats fail so miserably.
Yeah, fail so miserably. But on the other hand, name one city with more than 300,000 people that Trump carried. Not one. Not one.
No.
What does that mean? It means that we are a country divided in some ways by urban and rural. So where do you think, seriously, where does anyone think the future is happening in the world? Is it happening in the countryside or is it happening in cities? Where are the technological centers? Where are the growth centers? We know where the future lies. No. Sorry, I'm terribly urbanist about this, but I don't see any, I think that, you know, we need rural America, but we also need to understand that the future, the driving force, the propulsion has always come from cities.
Well, but then you're leaving out the suburbs. I think the suburbs are very important.
Oh, true, fair enough.
And fair those enough. Are well-to-do people who have a lot of power and a lot of influence.
Yeah, two things. First of all, a lot of the suburban growth was driven in part by white flight. We know that. So that the cities became dark and the suburbs became light. You know that that's reversing right now. The children of suburbanites are moving back into the cities, and people of color are moving to the suburbs. You know, I think you're right. I think suburban racism has underlaid some parts of the, you know, and I agree with you. The suburbs have been a driving force to the right in the United States, but I'm not so sure that that's going to continue.
Okay. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left. What is there anything in the book that you really want to get out and talk about?
I think the important thing for me, you know, when the book came out, I got a lot of media attention that was focused mostly on the chapter on the neo-Nazis and white supremacists, or some on the men's rights groups. But since the book was re-released, the book that you held up was re-released this month. And it was done because, so I could write a new preface about Donald Trump. So of course now the media attention has been about that. So I think the things I would want to say is there is nothing inevitable about this anger. I think anger as an emotion, I mean, here's what I would say, is I think we, and I'm meaning now liberals, Democrats, people on the left, do ourselves a great disservice if we want to say to these angry white men, you're wrong for feeling the way you feel. You never, it's probably the first rule of therapy, you don't tell people that their feelings are wrong. Their feelings are real. They may not be true, but they're real. They may not be an accurate analysis of their situation, but they're real. So you start there. Yes, your feelings are real. You have been screwed. There are things that are happening that are not good for you. But do you really think it's people of color who outsourced your jobs? Do you really think it's immigrants who are responsible for climate change? Do you really think that feminist women gave you those predatory loans? You're right to be angry, but you're delivering your mail to the wrong address. The right address is those people who have been issuing those loans, who have been preying on you, You know, there are financial institutions that act toward Americans the way people on your computer are fishing for you to click on a link that would drain your bank account. That's the way they treat you. That's not people of color. That's not immigrants. That's rich people.
What about religion? Is there a religion factor or connection to this?
Well, this is the part that always baffles me. I'm trying to figure this out. And if you have any insights into this, Rob, I would be very happy to hear it. I've always felt two things. I've always had tremendous respect for people of faith. I've always had tremendous respect for people who were religious and believed in their religion. And I believe that religions basically teach what all religions are supposed to teach, which is to be peaceful, to love your neighbors, to be merciful, to be kind. This is what every great religion teaches.
I have a problem.
Well, wait, let me finish. So here's my dilemma. How is it that this posture, which I regard as the ultimate posture, the great religious leaders have always been, had one characteristic that was common to all of them: humility. How is it that these religious leaders today are the most arrogant people that I've ever experienced? They are absolutely sanctimonious. They think they have an unquestioned access to truth that no one else can have, and are perfectly happy to foist it on others rather than let others find their way toward the path of the light. And it seems to me that any self-respecting Christian could not possibly have voted for the man who is currently in the White House, given the kinds of things he said with such disgrace about people of color, about women. What kind of Christian could possibly vote for this man? It strikes me as incomprehensible. I truly cannot understand it.
Well, in terms of your first question, I think that, you know, Maslow said that you have the people who start religions and they're inspired and they've had metaphysical experiences. And then you have the people who create the religion.
Right, the institution, yeah.
Institutions. And those people get glamored by power. And then it gets worse because the religious institutions have traditionally been tied to monarchies and kings and power. So you have all of that. So you got massive patriarchy tied into an awful lot of religion. And then you have fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. I don't have respect for fundamentalists, really, because they don't respect other religions. And I put together years ago my rules of religion. And the number one rule is I respect people who respect other faiths. And
Of course.
Don't respect other faiths. And so I think that's a problem. But the question is, how does the religion tie in with angry white men? Does it?
Not really. No. Most of the men that I interviewed, faith is not a big component. On the extreme right, on the super extreme right that I interviewed, they are part of cult religions, Odinists, Church of the Creator.
That's your chapter 7.
Yeah. Those religious cults or sects. Basically, you know, sort of posit that white Aryans were the chosen people and everybody. I mean, they try to justify political beliefs through some kind of, you know, religious ideas, but that it's not. But no, I think the groups that I've talked about here are largely secular. As I say, it does baffle me that people who claim to be of faith are some of the least humble and most sanctimonious that I've ever encountered.
So now you mentioned that you have a whole chapter on kids, teenagers, and these kids who go in and kill people.
Right.
And yet you say that young people is where the hope is.
Yeah.
Where do these kids separate from most of the young people? How are they different?
Well, these are the kids who are, you know, these boys all have a very similar story. They're all white boys. They're all middle school and high school. They're all suburban, and they all have access to guns. And you know, I think we as a country don't really have the political will to end these rampage school shootings. So, because I think that would require quite a large number of things. The first thing is, let's look at these kids. They're all the ones who get beat up and bullied and gay baited and just beat up. Their lives are like constant torture. So, you know, you hear these stories about girls being cyberbullied and commit suicide. Well, this is the boy version. The boy version is, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. I'm going to take as many of them with me as I can. Their goal since Columbine, since 1999, their goal has been to kill themselves. And so this is really suicide by mass murder, you know, like suicide by cop. These guys want to die. They want to go out in a blaze of glory. They want to take everybody else with them. And that's their plan. And prior to Columbine, the boys didn't die. They're now in prison. But since Columbine, they want to die. That's the first thing. The second thing is, what we know, of course, is that these boys, there's kids who are tortured, beat up, bullied in every school. So you have to ask the question, what is it about these specific boys? Why did they do what they did? And why don't other kids? And those answers have to do with the availability of psychological counseling. How come these boys flew under the radar their entire lives? No one noticed. If they were so crazy, so mentally ill, which is what we immediately said, oh, that boy must have been mentally ill. Well, how come they could be so mentally ill that they would take an assault weapon into their school and start shooting and nobody noticed? Where's the counselors? Well, I'll tell you where the counselors are. There aren't any, because we so underfund our schools that the schools can't afford it. That's where they are, right? There is one counselor for every, I think, 1,200 students in California.
Is there any tie between these bullied, beat up, teased kids and the angry white men?
Well, I think that they're a canary in the coal mine in the sense that they feel so aggrieved, that they feel like they've been so badly wronged. But I also feel that the thing that predicts resilience in some of these other guys, the boys who get beat up and bullied elsewhere, is that the other thing is that the characteristics of the schools that these shooters end up attacking are very, very, they're very similar. They're all, virtually all white. There's no minority kids. They're very often very evangelical. So there's really no other place for these guys to go, where they could find their own people, their own group, their group that says you're not awful, you're not terrible, we love you. You know, so it's either this way or nothing. And I think one of the things that diversity does is it gives us the opportunity to find different groups of people elsewhere.
Okay, time's about up. You want to wrap up?
That's it. I'm good.
You have a website you want to share?
Sure. It's michaelkimmel.com. My name, www.michaelkimmel.com.
All right. You've been listening to the Rob Call Bottom Up Show with Michael Kimmel, talking about his book, Angry White Men. Thanks so much, Michael. Great.
Thank you, Rob. Take care.